Clubhouse.
Join us every Friday in March for Love It or Leave It March Madness Edition. Because after all, we all go a little mad sometimes. Haven't you?
Welcome to Love It or Leave It, the March Madness edition. Sometimes we all go a little bit crazy. I'm Mike Caputo. Tonight joining us, we have Sheila from Pod Clubhouse. Hey, Sheila, how are you doing?
Hey, how's everybody?
Are you feeling a little crazy?
I am. You hit me on a crazy kind of a day.
Have you shaved your head into a mohawk?
Not yet. If I didn't do that for all of 2020, I'm hoping that I'll be okay.
Well, but, I mean, let's see how you're feeling by the time we're done with this podcast recording. Also joining us tonight, we have the guys from the Spy Hards podcast. We have Cam and Scott joining us. Gentlemen, how are you doing?
Doing very well. Thanks for having us.
Not too bad. Thank you.
I love having you guys on podcast because it really makes us, one, international, and two, we really span the time zones. I mean, there's currently like a 10-hour time zone swing between us all right now. And I feel pretty accomplished about that we're making that all work.
Yeah, now you know how it is for Scott and I to schedule podcasts every week trying to figure out time zones.
I was thinking about that while we were setting this up. I was like, I don't know how they do that. I mean, you guys have a successful podcast. Actually, why don't you guys tell us a little bit, for people who don't know, and they should absolutely know by this point. Tell people a little bit about the Spy Hards podcast and what you guys do on it.
Like you're saying, we're successful as well. We never have that intro, which is nice to have.
I'm here to gas you guys up. So that's all. I need you guys to keep coming back and doing these Leolis. So.
Absolutely. Well, as you led in, we're Spy House Podcast. Basically, every Tuesday we cover a spy movie. We pick one and we decide if it makes the list of what we call our knock list.
Well, the knock list is an acronym for the Need to See Official Classics of the Spy Hards podcast. So every week we tackle a different movie. It can be anything from a franchise film like James Bond or Harry Palmer or Mission Impossible. Or we sometimes do, you know, individual films as well, where, you know, Ministry of Fear, for example, or it can be anything. And we really break it down to the nuts and bolts. We look at the development of the movie, how it came to be. And then we really decide, you know, critically whether this movie deserves to belong on the knock list. So does it deserve to be in the pantheon of spy films? You would tell someone who'd never watched a spy film before that they had to watch. Like, there's no question mark. They have to watch this movie because it's one of the greats. And so we've had some really, I think, polarizing choices along the way. We've had some conflict, and I think it's been a lot of fun looking at some movies that maybe people look at as slam dunks that didn't make the list, and movies that are real sleepers that did make the list.
Can we fit Travis Bickle as a stalker of 12-year-old prostitutes and budding models turned politicos as a spy movie? Is there any way we can get Taxi Driver in there a little bit?
Well, Travis Bickle does say he's working for a secret government job, so I guess if you bend over backwards, you could accommodate it.
And to be fair, just this week we covered Men in Black International, so it's an open field.
did that one? I haven't listened to the episode yet. Did that make the knock list?
I'll give you one guess.
Hell no.
Well, I mean, listen, they can't all be winners. So, I mean, what are you going to do? As we said, we're doing March Madness this month. So every Friday in March, we're going to be doing a movie where someone went crazy or was already crazy and just started to show it a little bit. So our first entry is 1976's classic Taxi Driver. It was written by Paul Schrader. It was directed by Martin Scorsese, and it stars Robert De Niro. It stars a lot of people. Well, it co-stars a lot of people, but this is a Robert De Niro movie. We're also going to be covering Hitchcock's Rebecca. We're going to be covering Black Swan, and we're also going to be covering The Shining. So a nice setup of movies coming to you guys in March for our Love It or Leave It picks of March Madness. We don't have time for brackets. We eliminated it. We went right down to the crazy final four. Cam, what was your experience with Taxi Driver before getting on the mics tonight? Had you seen this movie? Was it important to you? Is it part of your film canon?
It's a movie that I love a lot. I can't say that it's one that's vitally important to me the way it is for some, but I remember, you know, when I was probably 17 years old, largely inspired by The Simpsons, I began to track down a lot of old movies because I would watch Simpsons episodes and there'd be a reference that maybe I knew was to Citizen Kane, but I didn't understand the context. And so that sent me down a rabbit hole of watching 2001, Casablanca, Citizen Kane. And at a certain point, I think in that first probably 20 movies, Taxi Driver was in there. And so I watched it quite young and then revisited it again and again over the years. You know, it's not a movie that I watch regularly, but it's one I check in with probably every 5 or so years just to remind myself of its brilliance.
How about you, Scott? What's your relationship with this movie?
I suppose I kind of echo what Cam said. It's just more of a case of it was slightly later for me. We were talking all off air before we started recording about our different ways we've approached films, and I'm more of a popcorn cinema kind of guy. So,
amen, brother. Like amen.
Yeah, exactly. If it isn't like a blockbuster, I probably haven't seen it. But I stumbled across, I think it might have been Empire Magazine or Total Film, like 100 movies you should see before you die. And this was just one of the films. And I don't think I watched all 100 in the end, but I watched most of them. And this was one of the ones.
I mean, this movie still regularly comes up on lists year after year as one of the best films ever made. It's between its iconic lines, between the Scorsese's directing, and between just the movie itself. It is always cemented on best of lists. I'm interested, and I'd like to take the conversation eventually at the end of this into, does this movie actually still hold up so well in 2021 in a couple different ways? But we can get there. We're not there yet. But Sheila, how about you? What's your relationship with Taxi Driver since you haven't committed so far to get a Mohawk it?
I rented this from Blockbuster Video. I feel like I was in my first or second year of college. And I think all the movies, the popcorn cinema movies that we wanted to see were, myself and my friend, were, you know, out for the Friday or Saturday night that we were renting a movie. So we stumbled upon, like, you know, just the ones in the middle that, if you remember how Blockbuster was set up, and we said, oh, you know, we haven't seen Taxi Driver. I'm like, yeah, all right, fine. It has that You Talking to Me line. So, yeah, so we watched it and I was just slightly appalled and somewhat intrigued to watch it again 20 years later. So
Let's start about, well, Molt, I'll give you my history of this movie. I actually never seen this movie before. Anyone who listens to any of the podcasts that we do whenever we touch upon movies, 9 times out of 10, I haven't seen it. I always feel very inadequate when I get on these podcasts just because I haven't seen movies. And I've seen a lot of movies in my life. I guess I just haven't seen the classics. And so this is a great example of a movie I know. I mean, watching this movie, I knew so many parts of it. I knew the story. It felt like I had seen it, but I've actually never seen it, which is probably a testament to how in the pop culture pastiche Taxi Driver is. You know, Cam, you mentioned The Simpsons. That's how I know these kinds of movies. Even the line, are you talking to me? You're talking to me? You got to be talking to me because I'm the only one here. I know that. I think from a Friends episode where I think Joey is doing the line and he's talking about how, like, I'd be insane if I wasn't talking to someone else, you know? So I know, like, all the references that way. Like, it's all like 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, how I knew this movie. So it was interesting to finally see it. What is Taxi Driver? What is it about? Here's the IMDb description, and we can talk about whether or not this really captures if this is what the movie is about. A mentally unstable veteran works as a nighttime taxi driver in New York City, where the perceived decadence and sleaze fuels his urge for violent action by attempting to liberate a presidential campaign worker and an underage prostitute. Is that sufficient, Cam, do you think? Is that a sufficient description of this movie? If someone told you that and then you sat down and watched it, or at the end of this, are you like, yeah, that checks out. That's what this movie is about.
I mean, it's a sort of a description that I think, you know, Roger Ebert would have said, it's maybe what it's about, but not how it's about it. So much of Taxi Driver, it's not about the plot. It's about the mood and putting you inside as close as you can ever get to being inside the head of Travis Bickle and just following this character journey. So do those things happen? Sure. But I wouldn't, you know, sell the movie to someone being like, it's about a guy trying to assassinate a political candidate. You got to check it out. You know, it's like, well, that's only a part of the psychological journey of Travis Bickle.
Scott, when you look at this movie and you think about casting and you think about Robert De Niro, can you imagine someone like a Jeff Bridges or even a Dustin Hoffman, two people who were actually considered for the role? Paul Schrader says he wrote the movie with Jeff Bridges in mind, and Dustin Hoffman actually was asked to do the role and he turned it down. Think about Taxi Driver with either of those two guys doing this, the dude or, you know, Rain Man, doing Taxi Driver, doing Travis Bickle. What do you think that movie looks like otherwise?
I actually struggle to picture them in the film. Obviously, I think De Niro has embodied himself in the character, so it's really hard to separate him from it. But at the same time, Jeff Bridges to me always comes across as a comedy actor, even though I know he's done some serious roles. And the other choice, no, I think it's De Niro. It's got to be.
I can see, okay, Jeff Bridges, I feel like, is way too good looking, especially in this era for that role. I mean, the whole thing with Travis Bickle is he's an outcast, he's very isolated, and he's kind of a strange fellow. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's right in Hoffman's wheelhouse during that era. You know, Hoffman does Midnight Cowboy in 1969. I could see him kind of carrying over that Ratso Rizzo performance to something like this. And he has that sort of look that you can totally buy that most people on the street would not look twice at Dustin Hoffman. Whereas Jeff Bridges, I mean, the man, you know, there's like the sparkle in his teeth when he smiles. That one I struggle more so with.
That's interesting and actually really speaks to De Niro in this role too, right? Because this is a really young De Niro who is just off of Godfather Part II, but actually when he signs the contract to do this movie, Godfather Part II hasn't broken yet. He was signed before that movie became the hit it was. And he was only paid $35,000 for this movie because of that contract, you know, and he didn't negotiate or renegotiate a salary increase. But De Niro in this era is very New York faced forgettable. There's not anything really distinctive about him from any other 500,000 Italians walking around Manhattan in the mid 1970s, which is interesting because he's so thin and kind of emaciated here. But there's a charisma about Travis Bickle, though, right? It's the thing that Sybil Shepherd's Betsy lights on. I mean, he's weird as fuck. But there is some kind of charisma there that draws him to her, at least initially, and until, you know, it takes her to the porno palace for a date. Sheila, you're a born and bred New Yorker. What about De Niro, if anything about De Niro, could you see if you were in a Betsy's shoes, makes him socially awkward, but also maybe be attractive?
I think she's attracted to like this like bad boy persona that he's putting off. Like she doesn't know him well enough to know that he's socially inept, borderline personality disorder at that point. I think she's attracted to like just the fact that he's not like the run of the mill. He doesn't fit in Palantine's office. There is a certain charisma to him, especially when he comes in and he leans over the desk and he's talking to her about volunteering. And he's like, no, I want to volunteer with her. And his gaze is fixed on her. So there's very much of an attraction on her part. And I even have this in my notes. I'm like, is she attracted because he's a bad boy? Is she misreading him as a bad boy? I was questioning, like, why would she agree to go out with him? Because my hackles as a woman were up. Like, I'm like, if this man approached me, I would be like, hello, like, can somebody get me out of here? I'm going to figure out a way to get myself out of this because
that's certainly Albert Brooks's, response, right? I mean, Albert Brooks in his first movie role as Tom here, that's his role is this guy is sketchy. What are you even doing playing with him, right?
Yeah. Everyone around him, except her, initially gets a very bad vibe off of him. Palantine in the taxi, Tom in any interaction, even just seeing him staring at her through the window in from the taxi cab. Everyone else has this immediate like hair on the back of my neck standing up kind of vibe coming off him. But she's initially attracted him. So I that's what I think. I think she's looking at him from a bad boy standpoint and she's misreading the social awkwardness that he gives off as something maybe more alluring than it is.
But I think that also says something, though, about her character. Right? Let's talk about Betsy for a little bit and Sybil Shepherd. Yeah, Sybil Shepherd, this is her third, fourth movie. You know, she had made a little bit of a name for herself from being a model turned actress. I think in 1971, it was kind of her big breakout. She actually also took a pay cut. She also only made $35,000 to make this movie. But there's an innocence about her, but there's also kind of a walking on the wild side. I think you're right. She likes the idea of him being the bad boy because no one would approve of that. Do you like Sybil Shepherd in this role? Camera Scott, I'll toss this out to you guys. Because famously, Scorsese was looking for a Sybil Shepherd type to play the role of Betsy. And then Sybil Shepherd's agent was like, well, I'll offer it to Sybil Shepherd. So she's really the only one that was considered for this role. But I don't know that I loved her in this part. What did you guys think?
Sort of echoing what was said before, I think the character was attracted to the mysterious factor of Bickle. But there's also that sort of power play going on, where I think she sort of, it's like a moth to the flame a little bit at the start, but then she starts to realize that it is a flame and it's probably going to burn her, and then she backs away.
I think Sybil Shepherd's really interesting here, and this is her shortly, really. I mean, it's only a handful of years after The Last Picture Show, which was her big breakout. And what I like about this character is that I think what also appeals to her with De Niro is he seems initially very motivated and driven. And pardon the pun with the driven driver, but
we'll allow it.
Yeah, I mean, this is someone who I think really believes in this campaign she's running. I think she appreciates sort of a very driven male figure, you know, in this case, the politician here. And I think, you know, when Bickle comes in, he's very, you know, he seems basically almost like tunnel vision. He's very focused. And it isn't until I think when she really sits down with him, he's a guy who's like, I don't know music. I don't know anything about movies. I don't really know anything about politics. And I think she really susses him out almost immediately. It's like, oh, this is a man who may be driven, but has absolutely nothing to offer whatsoever. Like I don't know. Like, watching the movie, so much of it is this exploration of the psyche of Travis Bickle. But, like, I made a note where it's like, is Travis Bickle even knowable? Is there anything to this man we can really walk away from the movie with? Because you see in this date, like, he's giving her nothing. Like, there's nothing interesting or attractive or anything to hold on to whatsoever. He just kind of seems like a guy who kind of mutters aggressive gibberish.
Well, I agree with you there, but there's a great split in Travis Bickle, right? Because you have his internal monologue, his journal writing that is expressed via the voiceover, and he's extremely eloquent, and he thinks of himself a real philosopher king, kind of, the way he comes off in his journal. So he has opinions, he has thoughts. He's not able to communicate it, though, verbally. You see it a lot, even in the scenes where he's hanging out with his taxi buddies with, you know, Peter Boyle, with Wizard and Doughboy. He's not able to speak, and it's not even social awkwardness. It's almost like a paralysis. You know, all of the eloquence inside his head, he's completely inarticulate, as I am being now. And so I don't know that he doesn't really know music or doesn't really know about things. I think he does. I think it's just part of his condition is that he can't actually express them. I don't know. It's a complex thing. It's a complex thing, the way they play it out.
I'd say I also get the vibe that he sort of shifts his personality or his quirks to whoever he's talking to. Because you say, like, when he takes a job at the beginning, he's kind of jovial with the boss. And then when he's talking to Betsy, he's more suave. And then she finds out there's nothing to it. It's just a facade. And there's all these times where he speaks to different people throughout the film. And he pretends to be different things to what he thinks the situation needs. Like when he's talking to the senator.
Right. And even there, where he eventually manages to say something beyond, I tell everyone to vote for you. But when he's actually pressed to come up with what he would do, it's just gutter language. It's right. There's scum and the fuck and this and the screwheads and that. And then the senator's just like, good Lord, get me out of this cab. But he is crafting himself to different people. I think you're right. And the way he treats with Iris, he speaks to Iris like some kind of father figure or demented older brother kind of way. So he is a bit of a chameleon depending on where he's at.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, when you think about those diaries too, there's information given in those diaries that is clearly delusional. Like, he's actually,
for sure,
he's living in another world. I like that they never nail it down. You know, I thought of the movie Psycho a number of times, and that at the end of the Psycho, you have that famous scene where the psychiatrist basically explains to the audience for 3 minutes exactly what Norman Bates's issues are, as only a 1960s pop psychologist could. And, you know, when I watch Taxi Driver, what I appreciate is they don't give you those answers. You know, Travis Bickle, we get these letters to his parents where he's talking about how he works for the government. And it's like, he has a girlfriend named Betsy. And then we have moments where he's
making
talking,
lots of money. He's hitting all the high points that he knows his parents want to hear.
Yeah. And then he's, you know, talking to Peter Boyle's character, Wizard, saying, like, I've got bad ideas in my head. So it's like, we understand this character is mentally ill, but the movie's not underlining exactly what his issues are. So we can look at the movie in a very open way where you can often question, is Travis Bickle actually talking to someone right now, or is he talking to himself? The movie opens up that sort of reading, and I really appreciate it for that.
Well, I think it definitely comes through, and then Sheila, I want to kick this to you, when he's doing the famous improvised monologue, you know, are you talking to me? One of the key lines in there is, I'm the only one here. And so often, Travis Bickle, even when he's around people, is the only one there for himself. And the way that so many shots are framed, even in when the Mohawk scene, when he shows up to canvas the I always want to say Palpatine, which is something I'll talk about in a second, is giving his speech. There's a huge crowd there, and he's still standing off in the back, isolated from everyone. So even when he's with people, he is the only one there. But the fact that he can write that wacky anniversary card to his parents, doesn't that show some kind of pathology that he is able to craft these different personas and identities and know what to say depending on who he's talking to? That shows some level of intelligence.
Well, do his parents buy it, though? Because it seems like every other character sees right through it, whether it's the poor woman at the porn theater selling refreshments. I love that he's buying chuckles at a porn theater, by the way. But, we see Betsy sees right through him. Albert Brooks' character sees right through him. The senator sees right through him. Do you think his parents? I mean, I would have to imagine they also kind of look at themselves with that weary look and are just like, oh, boy, that's our Travis.
I definitely know for certain that he has like some sort of like schizo type personality disorder. I mean, based on the social awkwardness that he feels, the inability to connect with people, like you mentioned the conversation that he's having with his fellow taxi drivers, like of all the people on Earth right now, these are the people that he has the most in common with, and he's still not able to connect with them. I think Wizard is the only one that he actually has some sort of an honest conversation with. I also question if he was actually in the Marines or not. I know he wears like a jacket and it has airborne on it, and it has camouflage and writing on the back of it, consistent with the Marines. But I do question whether or not that's actually part of his delusion or not. And I also question if the parents are in fact alive.
That was my big thought, was to Cam's point of what, do his parents even believe him or not, since everyone else is suspect of him. It occurs to me maybe the parents aren't even alive. That crazy, you're good scouts, you're a couple of good scouts anniversary card.
Yeah.
Like that's going to like the dead letter office. That shit's not going to anyone that's alive was my feeling watching it. So right. I don't know.
And, you know, just the lonely, disoriented, this alienated person. I'm not clinical in any way, shape or form, but I've had dealings with people who have schizophrenia, schizotypal personality disorder.
You promised me you would never talk about that on the podcast.
I maintained HIPAA, but in terms of just seeing what I see, like, so now watching it as a woman in my 40s, as opposed to an 18 or 19 year old teenager, I understood him a lot more. And I call bullshit on most of the things that he says about like his war record. I don't think it's PTSD. I think this is some sort of a childhood trauma that he suffered that made him this way. And the how quickly he snaps and goes from mildly socially disturbed to full on assassination attempt is a little startling. I was paying close attention to the timeline too. So I'm going to wager that most of what we know about him from what he said in the narrative, the voiceover, is kind of like BS.
That's interesting, though, but I'm going to take it to test there, because I think you have to put yourself a little bit in the shoes of when this movie is being made for some of that to make sense. This is a post-Vietnam, very reactionary to the Vietnam experience movie. And I think the PTSD is real. I think that is definitely part of his experience. I think his time in the Marines, honorably discharged, maybe, maybe not, but time served in Vietnam, seeing things that changed him in a bad, bad way, is, I think, definitely part of what Schrader and Scorsese were going for here as part of making him who he is. Did it create the condition? I don't know. Or did it just heighten something that was already existing?
Based on the timeline, I believe there was some sort of Vietnam service, whether or not he was as far as a Marine, because you do have to have a certain level of ability to follow orders and a certain level of intelligence.
Go watch Full Metal Jacket. Private Pyle, what's your major malfunction?
Yeah.
You know, there are many guns. This one is mine, baby. You know,
right. So. But at the same time, time served in the military is probably true, whether or not, like I said, it was Marines. But if it was the Marines, it would make me understand more how far his mind goes. Because if there was the slightest cracks in the foundation, the pressure of being a Marine in wartime would have definitely exacerbated anything that was there. But I do call just a lot of BS on some of the things that he says about his past and about his abilities.
Well, I want to take this, continuing this conversation, because I think this is an important part of this conversation, and especially if you're going to apply it to today and talk about Travis Bickle as a character that you could place today. Does it matter? Do the reasons for his actions, whether it's PTSD or mental illness, do they provide enough cover for the things he does in this movie and the actions he takes and the behavior he exhibits? I have in my notes here, Travis Bickle to me is Walter Mitty. Like, if Walter Mitty and a racist Oliver Queen had a baby with a helping dollop of delusion, straight delusion, like thrown on top of it. That's kind of the Travis Bickle character. So I don't know if it excuses it. I don't know if he's an anti-hero either. And that's a big part of the legacy of this movie, this idea, especially if you take the ending of the movie as something that's real, and the media kind of makes him a little bit of a celebrity, this vigilante celebrity. Is he an anti-hero? I don't know. Scott, what do you think? Does Travis Bickle fit, or is he just a villain who lucks out at the end?
Does he luck out at the end? That's another question in itself.
Dot, dot, dot.
Yeah, but I mean, philosophically, I think it depends on where you come down on crime. If a man steals a loaf of bread, he's committed the act of theft. But if he steals a loaf of bread to feed his dying family, is it theft? Yes? No? Like, where do you come down on that?
Can he sing in a falsetto? Can he sing Bring Him Home in a falsetto?
Bring him home.
Wait. I think the thing is, though, we all...
It's not a podcast, Cam and Scott, unless Mike sings. It's not.
I mean, we know that Travis Bickle dreams a dream. So,
I've taken by. Anyway, I agree with you. It is definitely a view on crime, right? Is there proportionate there? But that end, do we want to get to the ending? Because the ending, none of that needed to happen. None of that even happened. Even the girl that he's going to save, Iris, who he's going to save, is asking him, please don't shoot this guy. Her John, the guy she was with, he says, like, don't shoot him. So, Travis, no one asked you to do this. So, I don't know. He's not a good anti-hero for me. Because an anti-hero is someone you actually root for. I don't find myself rooting for Travis Bickle at any point in this movie. I find myself worried about him turning his sights on me more than anything else. Cam, where do you weigh in on anti-hero?
I think he's an anti-hero purely by the circumstances of how the movie turns out, or how this character's journey goes. Because the thing is, first off, we know he has this bizarre savior complex. We see this even with the Betsy character. He's referring to her as like an angel that other people can't touch. He sees the same thing in Jodie Foster's character. A lot of people like to point to this big shootout at the end with him saving this child prostitute as a moment of heroism for him. But let's remember, this is a guy who just moments before this whole attack was going to go assassinate a political candidate. That's how he was going to basically get his rocks off, in terms of this obsession with violence, this fixation he has. It's only because he got chased away from there that we get to this, him saving Iris at the end of the movie. So I don't know if he'd assassinated the senator. Do I think he would have gone and saved Iris? Probably not. And I think the movie is also hinting at the end, when he's in the cab and we get that weird, surrealistic, fractured shot of him in the cab, he's going to do this again.
For sure. And that's also assuming that that's a real ending and not the dying dream ending, right? The so long he gives to Betsy is so out of character for someone who has not learned his lesson and is so eloquent, out loud eloquent, that it really cuts against it. Now, both Schrader and Scorsese have gone on the record numerous times saying that he does not die in the apartment. He actually does live. That is a real ending. But I think there's a reason why this is a dying dream persists as a theory among people who watch this movie and then talk about it, because it is so fractured and unbelievable. I've watched a lot of TV shows, and you get shot in the neck in movies. You get shot in the neck and you bleed out like he's bleeding out. Your carotid artery, you're going to die.
And he shot multiple times, so I mean, like the likelihood of him not not bleeding out is very slim.
This entire film, Bickle is our narrator, but he also proves that he's not a very credible narrator. Anything we see is up for debate, I would say, anyway. But does he even go to shoot the guy? Is he maybe successful and killed at that point? There's lots of questions we could ask. And the other thing to actually finish off that anti-hero part, one parallel I drew in my notes is with the recent resurgence of the Joker. Mm-hmm. People just sort of lining up behind the Joker as their like their new hero or their anti-hero. It's quite scary how people just rally behind these anti-hero figures. They're not martyrs. They shouldn't be cheered on.
No, yeah.
And I mean, in 1970s film, that was a big thing, was the anti-hero. That's something that was studied a lot throughout film. But I mean, Paul Schrader has said that he saw this as a real condemnation of this championing of anti-heroes, and that if he did commit all these acts and he was someone who was unstable, what does this say about us that at the end he's a hero that we're writing glowing pieces about?
Yeah, no, I have a lot of problems with it. I do not subscribe to him as a hero. I'm affirmatively in the he is not an anti-hero. He is not a hero of any sort. That is not saving Iris, what he does at the end. That is just him fulfilling his bloodlust fantasies because of where he's been pushed to. But here's the thing. He's been self-radicalized. He's made himself the object of all of these attacks, all of these slights and slings and arrows that he feels put upon, in the same way Joker is in that shit garbage trash film. It's all of his own doing. And I can't personally root for someone like that, because that is a mess of your own making. So I'm never going to root for you because you're in this predicament because of your choices. Iris didn't ask for your help. We don't know that. We get a little bit conversation about Iris and her home life when they're in the diner and she's making that sugar sandwich. But we don't know. We don't know what her home life is that led her to run away from Pittsburgh to New York to begin with. God knows what she was trying to escape there. So there's a whole host of things there. Let's switch to Iris for a little bit, because that's the other big casting that we haven't talked about yet. Jodie Foster, she's probably actually the most experienced actor in this movie at this point. She had done a bunch of TV roles. She had done some movie roles. She had actually worked with Scorsese in Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, 2 years before. And so she actually is a pretty experienced actress. She was the Coppertone Baby when she was 3. That's when her career began. But she's also 12 playing a prostitute. What do you guys think about that? I mean, there are a ton of girls. We can go through the list of the girls who auditioned for this role. You know, Melanie Griffith was actually cast originally before she was let go, or depending on where you read, she was either fired when Brian De Palma was fired, or her mother, Tippi Hedren, pulled her from the movie because she was uncomfortable with it. But is it too much realism to have a 12-year-old playing a 12-year-old prostitute?
It's gross, first of all.
Well, beyond the idea of the 12-year-old prostitute, oh, yeah, and Harvey Keitel, oh my God. I mean, his fucking speech about her 12-year-old pussy is going to haunt me forever. But the idea of having a 12-year-old actress at the time this filming, is that okay? Is that ever okay, no matter how mature she may seem as an actor?
I mean, I guess if you have the right person, and I did some digging too, just to see like Jodie Foster in this role, because like you said, she was very experienced at this point, but I mean, like the level of experience, and she was about 12 years old at the time, correct?
Yes. Movie, well, she probably would have turned 13. This movie is shot in the summer of 75, and she was born in 62.
She's within like a year of that.
She's 12 going on 13 during the filming. She's 14 when the movie comes out about that.
So yeah. I like so when I did some research, I found that they actually had her talking to a psychologist while they were filming this, because it was part of, I think, California law that she needed to do this, and they did that. So it made me feel a little bit better about how they were approaching the role, that they weren't just throwing these big adult themes at someone who wasn't a big adult. But yeah, there was elements of it that the ick factor is very high. The Harvey Keitel like caressing her, and the line about her her 12 and a half year old pussy just being the best there is going to haunt me like you for the rest of my days. But the shock value of having someone who's 12 in the story about a 12-year-old, it lends itself to why this movie made such a splash and why it is so important, because there is like a level of authenticity to it that you're not going to get if you had someone who was older. And there was also just like Carrie Fisher was considered, Bo Derek was considered, Kim Cattrall, and Roseanne Arquette. I don't know if any of these people would have had the same impact that Jodie Foster had. Like, there was just like doe-eyed innocence to her that really resonated on screen for me.
Well, there's a maturity and a gravitas to her, even at 12, that I think actors twice her age, 3 times her age, she probably outshines most of the people that she's going to come up against. That's the thing with Jodie Foster, right? She is a phenom from the earliest age. But I still don't know. I mean, maybe I'm using a 2021 sensibility. I still don't know as the father of a 12-year-old son, that I would ever be okay with the subject matter. I know there's a social worker on set. I know they talk to her and stuff, but I don't know. I don't know if I'm ever going to be okay with that. Cam, Scott, what do you guys think?
It's such a different era, though, because, you know, you think of just a few years before this, what, 3 years, you've got Linda Blair in The Exorcist, mm-hmm. another role with a very young woman, or young girl, basically, dealing with very grim subject matter. There's a level of severity to the movies being made in the 70s that you just would never get now. They would not allow this to happen. For me, the whole point of this movie is Travis Bickle is, like, wading into hell every time. You know, we see right from the intro of the movie, he's going through the steam. There's like red light on his eyes. He's a guy who's addicted to this underworld that is hell. And he is numb to it in a lot of ways. Like, he's seeing the same stuff every day. So I think having this 12-year-old prostitute is that extra jolt to an audience, because they're seeing so much of what Travis Bickle's seeing throughout the movie. Why does she stand out more than the rest? I think when you have an actress like Jodie Foster in this environment, the audience hones in on her too. It's kind of a little bit of that, you know, the girl in the red dress in Schindler's List. Like, your attention immediately goes to this character and is like, oh my God, we've got to get this character out. The one thing I think that actually takes away a little bit of discomfort, a little bit, is that Jodie Foster is not a precocious child, and she has a maturity. I think if you had had an actress in this role who felt like a little kid, it would have been that extra bit revolting.
Also helping it is if you learn that her sister, Connie, who is 8 years older than her, was actually brought in as her body double. She was actually hired as her body double. And so several of the scenes that are of the more adult nature, it's actually her older legal sister who's actually standing in there. She isn't precocious, and that's true. And you look at her and you think, you could be older. I mean, she does have a bit of a child face, but when you hear her speak, she's got, like I said, a maturity and a gravitas that belies her age. And it is a different time and place. It's funny you mentioned Linda Blair. Linda Blair, after Melanie Griffith pulls out, Linda Blair is the one Scorsese wants to fill the role of Iris. But she also withdraws, and then they came to Jodie Foster. So Linda Blair was definitely the it girl for severe movies of this time period. Mm. How about you, Scott? Can you look at this in a 70s place without putting a 2021 morality on it? Because that seems to be where I'm having an issue.
I can definitely understand your point of view of being a parent, and you want to protect your children. I completely understand that. Who wouldn't? But I think in terms of the art and craft, this film demands a sense of reality, even though it plays with reality in itself. And by having an actor that was playing a role that's maybe they're 18, pretending to be a 14-year-old, some of that would be taken away. Whereas actually getting Jodie Foster, who is the right age to play this character, it actually just draws you in more.
It does. And so I don't know if you guys know the story of actually how this role comes about as it's written for Jodie Foster. Paul Schrader, and this is a bit of an autobiographical movie. He is someone who spent time not talking to people at all for a long period of time. He was homeless, living in his car for a period of time. He was suicidal for a period of time. He talks about writing this screenplay as kind of the exorcism of his demons. You know, I think the quote I read was, this was exorcism through art. The Iris character, as originally written, was changed because Schrader one night, when they were doing pre-production meetings in New York, is at a bar. Girl comes up to him. He hits it off. He thinks it's going great. He takes her back to his hotel, and a couple of things go sideways. One, she's a prostitute. Two, she's underage. And Schrader doesn't know really quite what to do with that, but eventually spends the night with her in some way. The sun comes up and they're still together. He calls Martin Scorsese up on the phone and says, Martin, I've got a child prostitute in my room. This is Iris. Come meet us for breakfast. We have to rewrite the character. And so the original character, whose name was Garth, becomes Iris that we know in the movie. Paul Schrader, interesting dude. I mean, that's a whole lot of stuff going on to come to your art.
I'm curious, have any of you seen The Searchers, the John Ford film?
I have.
Okay.
Yeah.
So The Searchers was, I mean, highly influential on Taxi Driver. And that's a movie starring John Wayne, for those who haven't seen it. And his niece is kidnapped by a Comanche group. And he spends like a decade plus searching for this young girl. And she is very young. I think like 6 years old or something like that when she's kidnapped. And this John Wayne character is not a good dude. He is very sordid soldier with a background on very questionable things. He's incredibly racist. Travis Bickle's also incredibly racist. And he's someone who decides he's going to save this young girl, Debbie, and commits himself to this and tracks her forever and ever and ever. And at a certain point, he finds her and realizes that she's actually joined the Comanche tribe and is potentially romantically involved with Scar, the leader of the Comanche. And at that point, he's like, I have to kill her. I have no option but to kill Debbie because of this. A lot of the story of this is this anti-hero in this case. If we're going to look at Travis Bickle as an anti-hero, very much like that John Wayne character where his motives are very questionable. And you also have this young woman or young girl that he wants to, I don't know, save, kill. Like, it goes back and forth depending on the psyche of the character. And I think it's very interesting that, you know, when this movie comes out, it's only coming out 20 years after The Searchers, mm-hmm. which really isn't that long. It's basically the difference between now and, I don't know, the Sam Raimi Spider-Man.
It's true.
But now, with so many years post-Taxi Driver, those two movies are much more in conversation than they probably would have been then. And so I just find that parallel very interesting. But that's where a lot of the impact of the Iris and the Debbie story in The Searchers comes from.
Or are there any other characters that stand out to you guys that we need to talk about, that you want to talk about, that you think are worthy of mentioning before we move on to other aspects?
I mean, Harvey Keitel, you got to kind of talk about, right?
Sure. Yeah, so he plays Pimp Matthew Sport. He was actually offered the role of Tom, I believe, and turned it down. He wanted the pimp role. He knew a pimp. He was friends with a pimp. He took the pimp down to the actor's studio and actually worked on improvisational lines and really got into character as this pimp. This is a disturbing character. This is the kind of thing where you have to go scrub your face, I think, when you go home after shooting, or not. I mean, there one talking to Travis is one thing, talking about how, you know, you don't want to fuck her because you'll be back here, all your money will go to fucking her after that. But then there's a scene where he's actually with Iris. My skin was just crawling. Sheila, what are you thinking of Harvey Keitel here as the pimp, as Matthew the pimp?
I question his moral character that he's attracted to and in love with a 12-year-old. And
Matthew, not Harvey Keitel, as far as we know.
Sorry. Well, I mean, he was hanging out with a pimp, so God only knows like what circles he was running in. It was the 70s in New York, so, you know, shit was wild. But Matthew just caressing, I mentioned this before, caressing, you know, Iris and saying how much he loves her and how much he needs to be loved by a woman like her. I'm like, she's not a woman. Like, she probably hasn't even like officially crossed that threshold. Not to be gross, but again, it's part of the shock of this era of storytelling and why this movie still resonates, why we're talking about it 45 years later. But yeah, it doesn't sit well with me. It's very creepy crawly.
Well, Cam, you brought him up. What do you think of Harvey Keitel's performance in this movie?
I think one of the most interesting decisions they made, actually, was to not have his character be violent towards Iris. Because, you know, when you watch a lot of 1970s movies, they're playing up the violent pimp character, right? Which is mm-hmm. very much a real world thing.
Sure.
And I'm wondering what audiences were walking out of the theater taking from that character then versus what we take now with much more. I mean, gaslighting is so discussed in pop culture now. Mm-hmm. So much of the focus of the last couple of years with so many of these Me Too stories coming forward that's been part of the conversation. So I think we look at this character in a much deeper way than I think maybe they would have even looked at him then. They would have known he's disgusting and gross, but I wonder if they're looking as much at the psychological tricks he's using on Iris.
This is the first three chapters of the grooming textbook, right? What he's doing here. When Iris even defends him, essentially, when Travis, you know, confronts her, don't you remember getting into my cab? And she blames herself. She says, I was out of my mind. I was stoned. Matthew Sport's not that bad. I mean, she's essentially defending him. This is 101 grooming behavior. What do you think, Scott? Harvey Keitel, is this a character drawn in a way that is interesting, sympathetic, someone, maybe not sympathetic, but someone that's not a cartoonish villain?
It's playing both sides of this one, because on one level it kind of just works as he's a pimp and he's in control of her, and you could just take it as that and not dig any deeper into it. But at the same time, you're right, it is like the first few chapters of the abuse cycle. This is exactly how it works. And you even in our discussion earlier, we were saying how Iris wasn't really saved by what Bickle did. But at the same time, she kind of was, because she was taken out of that toxic situation. So even that abuse cycle is working on our discussion in a way. So, but in terms of the character himself, apart from a very, you know, disgusting portrayal, I haven't got much more to say about the guy.
Harvey Keitel had worked with Scorsese a couple times. He'd done Who's That Knocking on My Door?
He had just done Mean Street with De Niro, right? I mean,
Mean Streets as well. Yeah. And so I just really love seeing Harvey Keitel in that 70s character actor mold. Like he is embracing this character for sure. He's taking it to the hilt.
I want to talk about, actually, and I think it's an interesting, I think it's something we have to talk about, is the race. Racism and the way it's dealt with in this movie, because it's actually a really pervasive when you watch Travis, how he goes about his life. For a guy who is delusion and as demented he is always aware and is always leering at the black characters in this movie who are not doing anything to him. I mean, you know, he shoots the guy holding up the convenience store, but otherwise the black characters don't do anything to him. All of the violence that he comes across are white characters. And the movie actually, because apparently Schrader's script originally had the pimp character and a lot of Iris's world were African-American or, you know, people of color. And they decided it was too much. It was too heavy. And they actually made them white characters. But if Harvey Keitel's character is black in the mid-1970s, you know, you talked about the stereotypical violent pimp. I feel like there is this characterization, and I think a lot of the pimp characterizations that we have come from the blaxploitation era. You know, the huggy bear, jive talking, big feather in the hat, fur coat, all of that comes out of the 70s era of that pimp style. And those are always black men playing those roles. So is it a little bit of whitewashing on the movie's part that the white pimp is maybe a groomer, but he's not physically violent? And Bickle's racism is always there, and we're always feeling it, and it's oppressively heavy in how he conducts himself, but it doesn't actually pay off in any kind of way. So why make that such a part of his character, do you think?
I think it just goes to show just how he's not able to function correctly in society, driving home the point that he has a mental illness. I just don't think that he's able to dissociate what a black man walking on the street is doing versus what he imagines that this man is doing or could be capable of.
Sure. But I mean, he sits there and Scorsese in his cameo role when he's in the back and he makes him watch the wife through the silhouette, violently talking violently about how he's going to kill his wife. Have you ever seen it? Have you ever shot a woman in a pussy? If seen what a gun does, a 44 Magnum does, violent talk, white guy. Black people just walking down the street, though, and he does double takes like he's about to get mugged with himself. And it's disturbing watching him react that way. He doesn't react that way to Martin Scorsese in the back of his cab. I'd be a lot more afraid of that guy than anyone else that he comes across. It's a really interesting character development. But also, he gets a gun. He buys the four guns from Easy Andy. And the first thing he does is shoot a black character. But otherwise, it's not really part of his eruption. So I was finding myself, I was like, what are we supposed to take from this? It's just, this is the 1970s and white men were racist towards black men? I don't know. What do you think, Kim?
Well, I mean, I think the thing with Travis Bickle, though, is that he is not a good person. The movie never tries to sell that. And I think the racism is there throughout to just keep reminding us. Basically, anyone who wants to take comfort in him as an antihero is always going to have to grapple with the fact that this character is portrayed this way throughout the movie. It's the sort of thing that in a 1970s movie, I know they were concerned if they did make the pimps, you know, black, cast them with black actors, that it could really kick off some severe problems. Like they just thought it was maybe too extreme to put out as a picture. And I wasn't alive in the 70s, so I guess let Scorsese and Schrader speak for themselves there.
Well, originally Schrader's original script, from what I read anyway, reading up on this, Schrader's script had it that way. Schrader's script went there. It was Scorsese and the studio pulled it back and said, no, too much.
Yeah. So like for me, the big part of it too is that scene with Scorsese, which is very jarring when you hear Scorsese dropping like the N-word and stuff like that too.
Oh,
one thing about that scene though, watching it this time, I still wonder if Scorsese was ever in that cab. Was that character ever actually there?
Oh, that's good.
Interesting. I mean, that's the final nail in his radicalization, right? It's that conversation that propels him to go buy the guns, not just one gun, not just two guns, but four guns, including the giant, ridiculously sized 44 Magnum. That's the event that does it. It's an interesting thing if it's just a mental trigger for him. And you don't know, right? I mean, that's what goes back to the beginning of this conversation. You never actually know what's real and not. Though Scott said it perfectly, Travis Bickle is the definition of the unreliable narrator.
Right. Is this a product of his own self-radicalization, or did something actually trigger it?
And right. We know that he has severe issues with Black people. We also know that this is after the Betsy incident, so there's probably some anger bubbling there, too, involving Betsy. And we have this Scorsese character who's racist and dropping very misogynist comments about killing women. These are both reflecting the two things that this character is grappling with in this moment. So it seems oddly coincidental that he just happened to pick up this guy at that point in time.
Yet, oddly, Martin Scorsese calls this his feminist film. So...
Well, I mean, I guess, Scorsese hasn't made, well, I don't know, he made Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. Does he not want to champion that one, I guess? I don't know.
Well, he says that he takes Macho to its logical conclusion that the better man is the man who can kill you. So he says this movie shows the kind of thinking and shows the kind of problems that some men have bouncing back and forth between their preconception of women and as goddesses and whores.
Right. And that's the arc, right? He goes on with Betsy in particular is, you know, she's perfect. She's misunderstood. She's on this island alone. And he's the only one who sees her and understands her
and can save her
decides that a porno flick is the right first date move. And then she's a whore bitch and is dead to him after that.
Worst first date ever.
I mean, if nothing else, y'all can take some lessons from what not to do from Travis Bickle. Don't buy Christofferson albums. They probably already have it. And don't take your dates to double feature porno flicks. I don't know. Scott, not that I'm going to lay you up with porno movies, but as a Londoner, how do you see race relations in America? And does 1970 race relations trigger for you in any kind of way? Because I'm always curious how people perceive Americans in New York City in 1970 and in the early 1980s is a very specific time capsule. And this movie is a perfect encapsulation of that time capsule. But I'm curious, as someone doesn't live here, how does that translate to you when you see this Travis Bickle character coming around there, especially given the authenticity that the movie is trying to go for?
It's kind of hard to say, because I mean, firstly, I recognize the fact that I'm a white man coming from a sense of a place of privilege. I don't know what racism is like especially in that time. I know we haven't got a very good history here in the UK either, so we can't say we're any better than anyone else. But I think that it was definitely a sense of realism involved with the racism. It was definitely crucial for the film for it to feel like it was of its time. And the other thing as well, I think it's important for the character to have that racist vibe to him. Well, no, it's not a vibe. He was racist. Because there's that whole sense of the other, and the fear of the other. And because this man is just a chronically lonely man with these mental health issues as well, of course he's fearful of things he doesn't understand. And I think the film did need that.
I think so too. I think this is, you know, when this movie came out and Ebert and Siskel reviewed it, Siskel panned the violent ending, that ending that almost cost this movie an X rating until Scorsese desaturated the blood and toned that down and to get it to an R. Siskel panned it and said it didn't add anything to the movie. It was just, you know, uber violence for uber violence sake. And Ebert made the point that if you take away the shootout, you have a very different movie. And I agree with that, but it also, you know, and I think the race is the same way. I think Travis Bickle hits you as a different character if you remove the subliminal and just underneath the surface racist overtones that he's giving off in waves.
And I appreciate that they aren't giving the audience an easy ride. Like, they're not letting them kind of say, like, well, he's actually a pretty good guy. It's just that society's against him. I like that they're working in very uncomfortable elements of the character so that the audience has to grapple with that. I think that actually works to its favor and probably why we continue to talk about it many, many decades later.
Sure. I mean, it's very easy. I mean, you especially take that shootout at the end, you know, he's the aggressor there. So it puts you in a position of either having to defend him or having to defend Matthew the pimp or the mafioso guy or the John, you know, in the room with Iris. That's a very uncomfortable position to be in. The guy who's just opening up, you know, spraying fire, or the bad humans who were at that maybe moment not doing anything bad, but were bad people nonetheless. So. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's interesting. Cam, talk to us about the Catholic aspect here, because you made a good point when we were off air about Scorsese and Schrader and their Catholicism and the way it seeped into the film. Well, walk us through a little bit of that.
I'm not a religious person, so there are Catholic listeners, I'm sure, out there who can speak maybe stronger to this, but it is a very strong element of Scorsese's films as well as Schrader's. Throughout this film, we have Travis Bickle in hell throughout. Like, the camera is making very clear that there is hell imagery going on throughout the film. We have scenes as well with De Niro's character, Travis Bickle, holding his hand over flame, testing himself essentially with the fires of hell. Also at the end, after he's been shot, the camera lifts up into the ceiling, into the famous shot, which is the God's point of view, because throughout the film we've been seeing so much of Travis Bickle's point of view. That's an omniscient God point of view, and so there is a lot of Catholic imagery going into this film. And, you know, Paul Schrader would continue to tackle men who were struggling with their faith. We never get a real sense of what Travis Bickle's religious background is, but he's obviously someone who's struggling with faith for humanity a lot. And Schrader would make movies like he did one with George C. Scott called Hardcore, very similar to Taxi Driver in a lot of ways. It's about a father, very religious father, trying to save his daughter from the porn industry. He also did First Reformed just a few years ago with Ethan Hawke, about a priest struggling with his faith. A lot of the themes that are in Taxi Driver are carried forward by Schrader, and Scorsese as well would do similar things in his work. I'm just curious if any of those elements jumped out to you guys.
He also made The Canyons, though, so I think cuts against it being a good Catholic, so I don't know.
True enough, true enough.
I'll say there's definitely the struggle with faith and a crisis of conscience and crisis of faith and humanity. I mean, this is a guy who he's ready to go Old Testament God, though, on New York. That's essentially what he's trying to convey to the senator, is you just need to start over again. If he had access to a nuclear bomb to wipe the slate clean, I think he'd be in favor of that and just starting over to reshape it in his image. And that's extremely biblical. I mean, that's as biblical as it gets. The idea that it's just gone too far into the irredeemable. But again, he's the unreliable narrator. So it's part of it is that's his perception, that he's taking all of the things he's seeing as personal attacks and personal slights. If it wasn't, I don't know that he would care so much. But he sees everything going on and he internalizes it as something that's being done to him or happening to him, which I don't think that's real. I think that's just his pathology. I think that's just his psychological makeup, though.
He does talk about also as well that a great rain is going to come and wash everything away as well.
Yeah. All of that. I mean, it was very Old Testament Bible, the striking it down, the washing the streets clean. Very, very old, angry God Testament. You mentioned the tracking shot at the end. Did you guys read about how they did that? It's a great little practical effect, how they got that shot.
What was it?
So that's an abandoned apartment building in New York that they filmed in, and the whole shootout took them 3 months to film. The whole shootout scene was filmed over 3 months. They actually had to cut a track in the floor, in the ceiling, and the camera was lowered down through the hole, and that's how it was able to track overhead so well through the apartment building, because that wasn't a set. That was an actual apartment, decrepit apartment building. So they hacked into the floor and cut a track into it and ran the camera along it.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's very cool. It's very cool. I love practical effects. I love the fact that this was shot in New York. I mean, I'm a lifelong New Yorker, born in 78. So I didn't know New York City of the 70s. But my mother worked in the garment district in Midtown, in Hell's Kitchen area of Manhattan. And I often went to work with her. And I remember very clearly the porn triple X theaters of that era, we would
get Times Square.
Yeah, Times Square. I remember vividly because my mother would grab my hand when we came up out of the train and we would hustle. Like, I felt like my feet never touched the ground as she ran me to the warehouse building where the coat factory she worked for was. This is very much of that 80s Manhattan that I grew up with. And so it resonated with me. But it's a really, it's a whole vibe. This movie couldn't be made in New York City today. And that I was trying to say it before about the race aspect. All of it, the dirtiness. This movie is shot in 1975, in the summer of 1975. There's actually a sanitation strike going on at the time. That's why there's garbage everywhere on the street. That was real garbage. It just worked out so well to make the city look dirty. Sanitation, the city was bankrupt in 1975. New York City was on the verge of bankruptcy until it was bailed out by the state and the federal government. New York was on the precipice of destruction. It was virtually at its death's door as a city. And this movie captures that so well. You wouldn't have that today going through Times Square. There are no porno shops. You're going to be accosted by a Winnie the Pooh before you get accosted by a XXX theater.
And the XXX theaters have been replaced by Lion King and Aladdin. And Disney has moved in.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't know. I think the Elmo will still probably sell you crack.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
It is disturbing when those characters take off their heads. It is weird seeing a Pikachu smoking a cigarette with its head dangling by the side. But I don't know if you guys have ever been to New York. I don't know if you have any sense of it. But there's a real vibe that this movie captures well. I don't know if you could smell it, but there is a smell coming through the screen in this movie. The sweltering heat. The summertime, there's just a whole sense that this movie captures. It's my favorite part of the movie, is the vibe of this movie and the way Bickle perceives it. The rain wash on the windshield, the neon everywhere, the gaudiness, the dirty gaudiness of it all, the filth. It all feels so real to me. I was really taken away and taken back in my memory watching this. As people who didn't grow up in Manhattan in the 70s, how does the setting feel to you? How did it affect your experience with the movie? Sheila, you're a New Yorker, but again, you're my age, so you didn't grow up in Manhattan in the 70s. But as a New Yorker, how did this movie hit you?
It really captured the powder keg aspect of what you were talking about with the bankrupt finances of the city, the pervasive porn in Times Square, the race relations just being horrible. So there was a lot not going well in New York at this time. And the fact that there was just a garbage strike on while they were filming just made the grittiness, that was real New York back then. And, you know, New York has gone through a metamorphosis over the last 30 years or so, where it's turned into this very refined city. Like, I don't know, you know, to Mike's point earlier, if you could shoot Taxi Driver in 2021 and capture the same feeling, the same hopelessness that this movie really captures. I remember graffiti on the trains. I remember Times Square. Like, we did not go to Times Square. And if we did, it was like, you know, grab, you know, by the hand and, you know, head down and let's go to where we need to go.
You would take a taxi to the door of the place where you needed to go to, and you wouldn't be on the street a second longer than you needed to be on the street.
Exactly. And there was never a moment where my mother's hand was not clamped down on my wrist, you know, tight as anything. So, it captured it really well. It brought me, it's like, oh God, yeah, like New York was really bad back then. But again, like, it's this powder keg feeling to it. Like, at any moment, there could be like a fight on the street. There could be a beer bottle thrown. Like, that was real New York back in the 70s. You also had on top of it the economic downturn that was going on at the same time. So there was a lot of poverty and there was a lot of drugs and there was just a lot of things that were going really, really poorly in New York.
Yeah, there's a sense of hopelessness that I think this movie captures. Maybe that's the word I'm looking for. Cam, you touched on the vibe of the movie before, and I don't know if New York was part of that, but does that form the feel of this movie for you?
Oh, completely. I mean, 1970s New York is one of the all-time great movie settings, and you had so many fantastic films coming out during that era set in New York. So, I mean, just the feel of it is so permeated through pop culture because of so many of these masterpieces. And I mean, Taxi Driver does it among the best I've seen. And
it really does.
It's just so atmospheric. You know, it's one of the toughest thing to do is to make the audience literally feel like they're there. You know, I think of Do the Right Thing, the Spike Lee film as well, which also made you feel that the heat of that summer in that film. But I watch Taxi Driver and I feel that New York. And, you know, we have an area of Vancouver in BC here in Canada. I mean, it's smaller than New York, but it's when I'm watching it last night, I couldn't help but think of that stretch of the city that is like that today, and no one really likes to talk about it, but you are very on edge when you have to walk through there.
Yeah, no, it definitely, the feeling of having to look over your shoulder, and not because of racism, just because you actually may be hurt, is a true vibe, and it's part of, I think, the desperation that this movie is wreaking. Scott, I don't know how the city feels, and if there's an equivalent section to 1970s New York, but how does Manhattan, the vibe of that, inform this movie for you?
You definitely get the sense of that claustrophobia and that sort of grunge, especially from the way this is shot. And I guess what, as you're saying about this strike they had at the time, but you know, I live in London. London is sort of a smaller version of New York in its core, and it has its own places. Now, I actually went to New York a couple of times, and one of the times we got out really late of a, I think it might have actually been the Lion King, funnily enough. And we couldn't get a cab for the life of us. And my other half didn't want to go on the subway. So we ended up having to walk from Times Square to, it must have been 30 blocks away where our hotel was, which isn't really that far, I don't think. But it was at like 12 o'clock at night. And as you move away from Times Square, you could just see things slowly falling apart. And you start to see the street workers, you would see people talking to themselves, and you'd slowly be more and more uncomfortable. And you definitely feel that they've captured that in this film.
There's a character that passes Bickle on the street. I think he's actually with Iris, and he's just ranting to himself. He's yelling and screaming to himself as he walked up the street. That guy, everyone knows that guy in Manhattan. Everyone sees 15 versions. If you spend more than 20 minutes on the street in Manhattan walking, Times Square or otherwise, you're going to see that guy 10 or 15 times. It's a weird, weird kaleidoscope of people. And it is such a melting pot of personality and mental illness and economic and socioeconomic differences. And it all just gets thrown together. So it always feels like this powder keg that's always kind of go off. This movie does capture it better than most. Summer of Sam is another movie that has a really good feeling for sweltering heat in the Bronx in the 70s. Amazon, if you guys are fans of the show Hunters, which is a great show on Amazon, also really captures late Manhattan, but you still get a real sense of this dirty vibe where you almost feel like you have to wash your hands after you've been watching the movie because it just feels kind of dirty.
French Connection's really good for that too.
Yeah, it is. Well, I think we're just about wrapped up here. I do want to talk about the legacy of this movie, because to me, I feel like this movie couldn't be made today. And there's been talks off and on for years of doing remakes. Scorsese's talked about it. Schrader has poo-pooed it. De Niro has talked about it. They've talked, you know, making sequels, Travis Bickle as an older man, or just doing a straight remake, reboot of the movie. I don't know if you were going to make it modern, if it would work. But I'm curious what you guys think of Travis Bickle in 2021. This seems like a character that would be an incel, radicalized online. But this character of the alt-right, I think, of the last few years in America, has very strong Travis Bickle energy. Curious what you think about the legacy of this movie as far as inspiring people like Hinckley, you know, who became obsessed with Jodie Foster and tried to assassinate Reagan, you know, put a bullet in his chest, you know, inspired by this movie, but also the radicalization and the alt-right movement and all of the incel army movement of the last few years that we've seen in this country. It all seems like there are roots in all of those movements to here, to Travis Bickle and to Taxi Driver. Is that too far? Is that holding this movie too accountable for too much, Cam, do you think?
Oh, I don't think it's accountable. I think this movie observes something in society and recognized it as something that could be a problem. I mean, Paul Schrader talked about people, you know, walking out admiring a character like Travis Bickle, or society admiring someone like this. And I think they saw the dangers of this type of behavior and personality. And I think we've just seen that, maybe we shouldn't have been ignoring them all these decades, because really bad things can happen.
History will repeat itself. You give enough time in between things and you're going to come back around again. People don't change fundamentally, right? From generation to generation. The Travis Bickles of the mid 70s is a human condition that still easily exists today, right? So, Sheila, talk to us about what you think about the legacy of this movie. Is it, you know, does this still resonate today, or is this from a bygone era?
I think it definitely resonates today. Again, like I was, you know, not yet 20 when I watched it the first time. And now having lived my life and having the experiences that I have, seeing it now is it's different. It was worth the 2 hours for me to see it. But just talking about the legacy of it, what Travis has dealt with in this movie is not new. He is another embodiment of extremism, and that has always existed. Different eras give these extremists different tools. So you talked about the radicalization online, the incel movement, maybe the alt-right would be up his alley if this were a 2021 lens looking through this movie. The pathology is always there. It's just they have different tools at different points in time. In the 70s, he had Easy Andy and he had the porno theaters and that self-isolating mentality that he just fed into. That was the mechanism and the vehicle in the 70s, whereas now you have the whole internet at his disposal where it would just look different. But the foundation, the roots of that, the moral fiber of what makes him doesn't change. There's people who exist today who you could have plunked in 1970s and they would have existed in the same extremist way. Just how they expressed themselves would have just been in the vehicle of the moment.
I mean, good Lord, could you imagine what Travis Bickle's subreddit account would look like today? Jesus
Christ.
Oh, my
God.
Yeah. Scott, you dropped off. You were talking about toxic masculinity, and I think it's an important point. Can you want to just circle back to that again before we move on to Love
Yeah. I'll just touch on the fact that toxic masculinity is not a new thing. You know, we're just more aware of it now. So this whole, you know, I suppose the question is, if it was being remade now, how would the toxic masculinity show itself on the screen? Obviously, in this film, he shoots up the house and all those little other things he does along the way, kills the guy in the shop, da-da-da. How is that portrayed on the screen this time in 2021? Because most of this stuff is all online now. Mm-hmm. These guys are just keyboard warriors. What is the big moment at the end of the film?
It's true, yeah.
I don't think they would remake this movie, honestly. I think we've already seen variations on the form in Joker, obviously, but also Nightcrawler, the Jake Gyllenhaal movie. We've seen sort of the legacy of Travis Bickle continue in these characters that very much represent this archetype. And I'm not a particularly big fan of Joker either, but I think Nightcrawler did it incredibly well.
Nightcrawler is an excellent movie. Joker is not. So Paul Schrader says in 2014 that it's not being remade. He says it was a terrible idea, and in Marty's mind, it was never something that should be done. Because this stemmed out of 2010 Variety article that Scorsese and De Niro were allegedly talking about doing a remake of the film or continuing Travis Bickle's story. De Niro had given an interview talking about he thought it was an interesting exercise to think about Bickle as an older man. So I think that's why it comes up, and I think it periodically has come up since then. But I think Schrader is right. It doesn't need to be redone. And again, it would be a fundamentally different movie. You couldn't do this same movie today, and if you were going to still place it in the mid-70s, well, why? You already have that movie. So, you know what I mean? It would only be interesting to do it if you contemporized it, and I don't know how you make this contemporary without telling something that's already been told before.
And everybody would just be offended massively.
Mm-hmm.
Scott, you hit on a great point about toxic masculinity, but moving to the internet, it's this fun, and I'm using fun in air quotes, meeting point of cowardice and anonymity of the internet and its cowardice combined with toxic masculinity, where you can talk real tough because you don't have to actually face anyone, and you could say the worst things and bring out the worst parts of humanity because there's no accountability online. That's the vibe today, right? It's in some ways it takes a real man to grab a gun and go in somewhere, you know, versus saying the worst possible things online, which is the new form of cowardice. So
yeah, you can see here that in Taxi Driver, there's much more of that trying to evoke sort of the frontier spirit. You know, you have Travis Bickle in like cowboy boots versus like now, whatever you would get now, I don't know what they would be evoking. Like Travis Bickle would be someone who would be very much looking to that Wild West model. I don't even know what nowadays they would be looking at as their model of masculinity.
I mean, no, I don't know. I mean, I think it would probably involve a parlay account, and it would probably involve, you know, rolling back women's rights. You know, it would involve a lot of things that are abhorrent, but, you know, still continue to seethe in certain sections of this country and is pervasive in a very dangerous kind of way. I think it's just not socially acceptable to talk about it out loud anymore. The same way you couldn't get a Jodie Foster 12-year-old cast today, probably. The societal norms of what is acceptable out and about in front of people, it has just changed, I think, so much that you couldn't show these things. People wouldn't have a stomach to see these things. Even if they were true, they wouldn't want to actually put a light on it. You know, I think that's kind of the mood of the country. It's our show, so we get to say whether or not this movie is worth going to see. And, you know, it's on Netflix through the end of March. But it is our show, so we get to say whether we love it or leave it. So we're going to go around the horn real quick before we wrap up and say whether or not we love it or leave it and a quick little reason why. Scott, I'm going to start with you. Taxi Driver, love it or leave it?
I am a love it guy for two reasons. Firstly, I don't think this film could be made again. It is a product of the 70s, and it should stay that way. And I feel like it's a perfect encapsulation of filmmaking at that point. The second reason is purely just the performance from De Niro. It's just phenomenal.
I think you strip away everyone else in this movie and just make this a monologue, you know, and I think this movie is still probably as effective because of, I think, the strength of his performance. How about you, Cam? Love it or leave it?
Oh, love it for me, big time. I mean, Scorsese is one of the definitive directors of my lifetime, for sure, and of his generation. And I think this is in his top, what, maybe three or four movies? You know, I'd be looking at, like, Goodfellas, Raging Bull. But there's not a lot else that would edge out Taxi Driver in my eyes. And it's like Scott said, the performance of De Niro is just next level. It's one of those great, did not win the Best Actor Oscar performances, but it's certainly iconic. And I love that we were able to watch this movie in 2021 and continue to have, you know, I think fairly deep conversations about what it's trying to say, how it applies to now. I think that's one thing that's incredibly important. I don't care if the movie has 1970s politics or, you know, ideas or concepts. The thing is, we can apply it to nowadays. We can look at this movie and see how it mirrors society now. And that's where the importance comes from, not whether it is, you know, outdated in some of its storytelling, because it is a product of its time, but it's one that history repeats itself. And we can see a lot of what's going on nowadays in the storytelling of 1976.
Sheila, what do you think? Love it or leave it?
I definitely think it's a love it. To Cam's point that there are certain elements that don't hold up well, but as a mirror for society, I agree that this is something that is important. It's important storytelling. I like the implication of the end of the movie is that Travis, he was so hell-bent on cleaning up the streets and cleaning up the scum and the filth, but all he did was contribute more to the filth. So the irony for that is alive and well for me. There's also a line that he says in one of the iconic lines, not the iconic line, but there's never been any choice for me. And that's also part of the narrative that's resonated as well, that he felt that he was preordained for this and somehow he was above the fray and that he alone was going to be the savior of not only New York, but in particular these women that he found to be very important to him. I also like that Betsy said that he's part truth, part fiction. He's a walking contradiction. That being revisited at the end scene that happened in his head as he was dying, that's my take on the movie, that it really drives home the point that he set this up himself, that this was his own self-radicalization. And just the fact that Robert De Niro is Martin Scorsese's muse, I really enjoyed this deep dive character study into someone who's so disturbed and so just unhinged and allowing us to kind of see his world and see his progression. It's really still fascinating all these years later.
For me, this is a love it, though I think there are parts of this movie that don't hold up well because I think they're a little bit anachronistic or at least just wouldn't be told today if you're going to do this movie. But I don't think you would want to do this movie today. The Travis Bickle character study is the important thing about this movie. And I think that's the thing that makes it a love it. I think De Niro's performance, I think the depths that he plumbs the character of Bickle. He really feels like he understands this character. He really feels like he is putting forth for all of us to see every bit of this man and really turning him inside out. You know, as Scott said, is he knowable? I don't know if he's knowable, but to the extent he is, I think De Niro shows us all of those things. My favorite movie ever is Godfather Part II. A lot of that has to do with De Niro's performances, the young Vito Corleone. And that's a whole performance that always felt very natural and very Robert De Niro for me. He's always been my gangster, you know, from Godfather and from Goodfellas and Casino. That was always his vibe. But watching him take on this role of Travis Bickle made me appreciate him in a way I don't think I ever fully appreciated his skill. And I think it is, well, I love it and a must see purely for his performance, but I think there's a message there that we can definitely apply to today and understand why and how people behave in certain segments of our society still today. I think the character study of Travis Bickle is helpful in understanding that. And I think art is best when you can use it to kind of help understand the real world and apply the lessons, because I think it allows us to speak in a medium where people can talk about things reasonably without being necessarily offended, you know, because it's fictional. So I think for that reason, this remains kind of an evergreen movie because of that character is forever worthwhile talking about and having different views, you know, as time marches on. So for me, it's a total love it. Cam and Scott and Sheila, thank you guys so much for coming out for our first March Madness. Guys, Cam and Scott, where can they find Spy Hard's podcast? Where can they find you guys on social media?
Well, you can find us basically everywhere at Spy Hards. That's SPYHARDS. And, you know, they say all the animals come out at night. Well, we come out every Tuesday. So we'll see you there.
I don't know. everyone always talks about you talking to me, but it's the I don't know that has always stayed with me. The I don't know. Where can they find you guys on social media? You guys have your individual accounts, or should they just find at SpyHards on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, all that?
Basically everywhere. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. We are just SpyHards, SPYHARDS. And we're always active on basically every medium. We're even on TikTok, apparently.
I love that. I love that. Are you guys doing some floss dancing? Is that what's happening? Wearing your spy outfits?
Coming soon.
It's just us replicating the near nude scenes from Austin Powers.
Do I make you horny, baby? Sheila, where can people find you on social media?
I'm on Twitter at Shields McGangsta, and you can find me through Pod Clubhouse.
That's perfect. Guys, thank you guys so much for coming out. I hope that you had fun. I hope you enjoyed talking about Taxi Driver with us.
It was a great time. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it was fun. Thanks, guys.
Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to Love It or Leave It and Pod Clubhouse Podcasts on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. For more information, you can visit us online at podclubhouse.com. We're on all social medias at Pod Clubhouse. Come leave us a message. Talk to us about what you think. And if you're feeling like you're going mad, well, don't take a date to a porno movie. It's not going to end well. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening. This has been an original Pod Clubhouse production. Pod Clubhouse is a podcast network dedicated to encouraging collaboration among podcasters and friends to bring a fresh voice and diverse perspective on a wide array of content. Please visit and leave a comment for us at podclubhouse.com. Rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast feeds on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can find us at Pod Clubhouse. Our DMs are always open, and we'd love to hear from you.